That's what has happened to us. Because we, right from the time we are born, we are with this body. And so we somehow think, this is me. And therefore, what does death essentially mean? The destruction of the body. But because I have begun to see the body as me, the destruction of the body appears to be my own destruction. And everything that is done by the body, I feel I am doing it. So ahankara vimudhatma, it's only we become vimudha, we become deluded, by which we think this is me. There is a story told in the Bhagavata. Once the great Rishi Vyasa, he was sitting on the bank of the river Jamuna. Jamuna or Yamuna, some people pronounce it Yamuna, some pronounce it Jamuna. So they were sitting on the bank of the river and he was meditating. And these gopis, milkmaids of Vrindavan, they were selling all this milk and butter and all this and ghee. So they had to cross the river to go on the other side to sell their milk products. And it so happened that the river was in flood. The bridge over it had been washed away and there was no way they could cross. So they appealed to this great Rishi and said, we need to go and sell our milk on the other side in the village, but how are we going to cross? Could you do something? And then this great sage says, I will do it, but first I am hungry. So he sees very delicious milk and butter and all that is there. So he said, if you give me something to eat, then I can do something. Then they said, all right. So they gave him some milk and butter and he just fires everything. And then he gets up and looks at that river and folded hands. He tells the river, if I have not eaten anything today, then make your what? Part your, just like Moses at the time of Exodus, part the waters. And then whole the river, the waters were parted and then these women could cross over. They are like dumbstruck. Right before our eyes you have nicely had a heavy meal and then you say that if I have not eaten anything. Now how did that happen? Because he ate it, but he did not have the sense of ego. He was that I am the doer, that this body is me. And therefore he was not affected by that. So he was not telling a lie, he was being very truthful. Now this story is told to show how when we become enlightened, we will continue to do good to the world without the ego that I am doing it. The major problem in life is this ego. And ego has two functions. Ego as the agent of action, that in Sanskrit is called karta, that I am doing everything. I do. And a second function of the ego is bhokta, I experience. And so, if someone pinches me here, I feel pain. I say, oh, I'm experiencing pain. But, I mean, what is essentially happening is, this body is being pinched, that's all. But because I feel this body is me, I'm feeling the pain. If somebody else's body is pinched, nothing happens to me. In fact, I may even enjoy it. So because I don't have the ego in that body, my sense of I-ness is not connected there. So wherever our I is, then we will be affected by whatever happens to that thing. And you can see that it's not like our I is always connected with this body. For instance now, when you go to sleep. When you go to sleep, at least temporarily, your eye is withdrawn from this body. So if you just go and tap a person who is asleep, that person will not respond at all. If you don't do it too vigorously. Because that's eye, temporarily, that eye has withdrawn from the body. Which is why, if you have any physical pain, and if you go to sleep, sometimes it may be difficult to fall asleep when you have physical pain, but everyone falls asleep. You can never remain without sleep indefinitely. So as long as you are asleep, you will not feel the physical pain. because for that time your sense of I from the body is withdrawn. You will not even feel when you are deep sleep, when your even mind falls asleep, all the worries and anxieties that you have in the waking world will disappear because your sense of I has been withdrawn. So in a sense, in a state of deep sleep called sushupti, you don't have the sense of I, the ego, connected with the body and mind. And while our waking experience can be painful, our dreams can be sometimes painful, but there is no one in the world who can say that in that state of deep sleep, it was a very miserable deep sleep. Nobody says that sushupti, deep sleep, is always a state of peace and joy. Anyone, rich or poor, east or west, anyone, a person who is fast asleep, who is not even dreaming, is in a perfect state of bliss and peace. Because in that state, that ego attaching itself to the body and mind is temporarily withdrawn. Now what the Gita says is that it is possible to keep that withdrawal of the sense of I from the body and mind even when we are awake. If we can do that, then we will remain unaffected by the ups and downs of life. We will remain unaffected by the joys and sorrows of life. Will be able to remain equi-minded, equipoised. And that's the state of mind we all want. So what really prevents us from being calm and peaceful and clear-sighted in life is that our ego. And ego has two dimensions. One is the primary ego and the other is the secondary ego. Primary ego means everything that makes me see as I. So primary ego with the body, primary ego with the mind. Then everything that we see as mine is a secondary ego. My book, my home, my family, my friends, my car. So everything that I call mine is a secondary. There is this sense of I going and looking upon things as their possessions, and a sense of I which is identifying with it. So this I and mine, Sri Ramakrishna used to say, I, the sense of I and mine, is at the root of all trouble. If somehow we are able to say, not me, but you, you and yours, everything God is you and everything is yours, the more this I and mine will go away, the happier we will be. They say the story of Guru Nanak, you must have heard that. When he was young, one day he got a job in one farm, and after the harvest they had to count how much grain was harvested, and there's this measure by which there's this heap of grain here, you fill that grain and then you put it, and then you know how much it is collected. And so he had to count, of course. So he began, of course, the story goes, began in Hindi, says, ek, do, teen, char, paanch, che, saat, aat, nau, das, gyara, bara, tera. When he came, tera, he said, tera. Then the whole heap he counted, tera, 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 tera. Because tera also means it's all yours. So when he came to that tera, suddenly his mind just thought, oh yeah, everything belongs to God. And then he forgot to count, the whole heap he said tera, and of course he lost his job. So that is what it means about removing the ego. So the more we are able to see everything around us as really belonging to God, and God's gift to us, that our family, our friends, our possessions, everything that has come, it really belongs to God. But God has given them in my custody. And if we love God, we will take good care of all these things. So when it is said everything belongs to God, doesn't mean that you have to give up everything and go to a forest. That we continue to be where we are, but we look at our possessions with new eyes. We see things as not really mine, not really mine, but everything belonging to God. And the more we do it, the happier we will be. And that is what this verse says. A person who thinks I am the doer is actually deluded. 28. Tattvavittu Mahabaho.
Tattvavittu Mahabaho.
Guna karma vibhagayoho.
Guna karma vibhagayoho.
Guna guneshu vartante.
Guna guneshu vartante.
Iti matvana sajjate.
Iti matvana sajjate.
That almighty armed, the one intuitive into the nature of guna and karma knows that gunas as senses merely abide with gunas as objects and does not become entangled. That's what I was saying. So when I say I am reading the book, essentially these gunas which constitute the book, the gunas which constitute my hand and the gunas which constitute my eyes, these gunas are interacting with each other, that's it. But somehow I look upon some gunas as me, a few gunas as mine, and then I say I am reading it. So if you can look upon everything as just a play of gunas, then we become the intuitive one, the one who is able, tattva vit. Tattva means the truth, vit means one who knows. So when we are able to look deeply and understand reality, understand truth, we will be able to watch everything as a witness rather than getting entangled into it. 29. Prakriti gunasammoha.
Prakriti gunasammoha.
Sajjante gunakarmasu.
Sajjante gunakarmasu.
Tan Krishna vido mandan.
Tan Krishna vido mandan.
Krishna vinna vichalayet.
Krishna vinna vichalayet.
Those deluded by the gunas of Prakriti get attached to the functions of the gunas. The man of perfect knowledge should not unsettle the mediocre whose knowledge is imperfect. So, it is the gunas that delude us, and it is these gunas because of which we go through the ups and downs of life. Now, it is said, if someone who knows the truth were to simply go and say, oh, this is all wrong, all of you fellows are doing wrong, then people can get confused because we have been doing things in a particular way for a long time. So someone suddenly coming and saying it's all nonsense can confuse us even more. And that is why all great teachers, they take the student where he or she is and from there, step by step, gradually show them the path to the truth. And that is what we do. If suppose you go to school, if the teacher simply tells you that whatever you have been doing so far is wrong and doesn't give you any substitute in its place, then it can be very confusing. So a good teacher therefore always take wherever the student is and from that level gradually guide and lead the student. 30. Mai sarvani karmani.
Mai sarvani karmani.
Sanyasya adhyatma chetasa.
Sanyasya adhyatma chetasa.
Nirashir nirmamo bhutva.
Nirashir nirmamo bhutva.
Yudhyasva vigata jvaraha.
Yudhyasva vigata jvaraha.
Surrendering all actions to me, with your thoughts resting on self, freed from hope and selfishness, and cured of mental fever, engage in battle. Here battle really means not that just go out and start fighting, but here the context is war. So the problem before Arjuna was, now I'm in the battlefield, should I fight or not? And what Krishna is saying is, at present your duty is to fight. So engage in battle means do your duty. So this is a call to all of us. How should we do our duty in life? Surrendering all actions to me. Recognizing that we are doing everything not for ourselves but out of love for God. With your thoughts resting on self, the real self, not getting caught up by these coverings of body, mind and ego. Freed from hope and selfishness. And what does it mean freed from hope? Some of you may have heard the saying, Ashaahi paramam dukkham, nairashyam paramam sukham, that to have any kind of hope is a good recipe for pain. And to be completely hopeless, you can be happy. But I sometimes jokingly say that an optimistic person optimistic people tend have a greater possibility of feeling sad, and pessimistic people have a greater chance of feeling happy, because an optimistic person always sees good, positive, and of course things are never always good. Sometimes things don't work out well, and but you, since you are always thinking everything is going up to turn out good, then you are going to feel unhappy when things turn out bad. On the other hand, if it's a pessimist who thinks everything is just terrible, and everything is never really terrible, some things are good, so you have a pleasant surprise. You are never really expecting something and some things turn out good. It's not, I'm just, this is only a joke, so it doesn't, not a call for everyone to be pessimists. I think we all need to be realists. Realist in the sense that recognizing that ups and downs in life are natural. In a way, we all of us have both. We have hope, we are hopeful about a few things, and we are hopeless about a few other things. Depending on what we are hopeful about, and depending on what we are hopeless about, makes the difference between one person and another person. What is interesting is, most people pin their hopes on things over which they have no control. I hope tomorrow will be a sunny day. So, really, it's not in my hands at all what kind of a day it's going to be. And yet we hope, or we say, oh, we hope now the war will come to an end. We hope the economy will improve. It's nothing wrong in hoping, but what I'm suggesting is that all these hopes are about things over which we have absolutely no control. On the other hand, about things over which we have control, we are pretty hopeless about. Things like, even those who practice meditation, sometimes we already decide in advance, or today I'm doing 10-minute meditation, and after meditation I have to go and do shopping, and then I have to do this, and then I have to do that. So what it really means is that we are very sure that nothing great is going to happen in that 10 minutes of meditation. But if meditation is really meant for enlightenment, then how can we be sure? Maybe today when I sit to meditate, I may become an enlightened person. I may be freed from this cycle of birth and death. I may not have to go shopping at all. But we make all these plans in advance because somehow deep down we know that our little meditation, nothing is going to change. So we are quite hopeless. We are hopeless about our spiritual progress, but hopeful about the weather, the economy, the politics, over which we have no control. Now what Krishna says, we must reverse that. And that is, accept things as they are. Well, it will be good if the day is sunny, but even if it is cloudy, I can still be happy. Don't pin your happiness over factors over which you have no control. On the other hand, yes, I can pray, I can meditate. Over that I have complete control, but we are totally hopeless about that. If we can change that, then that is what it means by being freed from hope and selfishness. So it doesn't mean that we shouldn't have hope at all, but we should have hope in the right things. They say there is a saying which Swami Turiyananda, a great disciple of Ramakrishna, used to quote. In one letter he writes, it's a Sanskrit verse which says, Tad dinam durdinam manye megha channam na durdinam yat dinam na hai sanlapam katha piyusha varjitam. That means, Tat dinam durdinam manne. Consider that day a bad day. Megha channam na durdinam. A cloudy day is not a bad day. Then which is really a bad day? A day that is spent without thinking of God even once. That is a bad day. And so we have to rework our definition of what is a good day and what is a bad day. A thing, day might be perfect weather, wonderful, and you have not thought of God even once. But from a spiritual standpoint, that is a bad day. Or a day could be cloudy or snow and cold and your heating system has failed, but you are continually thinking of God. And that's a good day. So again, which is a good day or bad day will depend on what your priorities in life are. And cured, and all if we live that way, then we'll be cured of what he calls mental fever. Vigata jvaraha. And then we have to do our duty. If we can do our duty following all of this, then that will purify our heart and will free us from all the limitations under which we live. Verse 31. Ye me matamidam nityam.
Ye me matamidam nityam.
Anutishthanti manavaha.
Anutishthanti manavaha.
Shraddhavanto nasuyanto.
Shraddhavanto nasuyanto.
Mucchante te pi karmabhihi.
Mucchante te pi karmabhihi.
Those who ever abide in this teaching of mine, full of Shraddha and free from cavilling, they too are released from actions. So what is important is not simply understanding these teachings, not merely intellectually grasping these teachings, but actually practicing them. And for practicing them, we need Shraddha. What does Shraddha really mean? Shraddha, a very light translation would be faith, but Shraddha is little more than simply faith. Shraddha is a kind of gut feeling. It is like you know the truth of something, but if someone were to ask you to prove it, you have no proof right now. You have not had a direct experience yourself. You cannot prove it to anyone, but deep down you know it rings true. Then you can say that, then I have Shraddha in it. Only when you have that kind of Shraddha will you want to invest your time and energy into it. Otherwise, the question can come, oh, this Gita is very ancient book, sure. How do I know it's true? Why would I want to spend my energy and time practicing this? So unless there is some amount of deep conviction, that conviction is not in the sense of not cerebral, but deep down there is this Shraddha, that feeling that this is true. Only then will we want to take the trouble to actually practice it. Because without that, it would seem pointless to practice something in which you have no faith. So that Shraddha is very important. Spiritual life begins with faith, but it doesn't have to end there. In fact, faith must mature into experience. Once you experience something, you don't need any faith. Now, for instance, if my eyes are closed and someone tells me, oh, I have put a glass of water on your table. Now, depending on who that person is and how much faith I have in that person, even though I may not see the glass, I may think, oh yeah, I can trust that person. There is definitely a glass of water here. I have not yet seen it, I don't even know. But I have faith because someone told me it's there and I trust that person. And so I can say, I have faith that the water is there. Then I open my eyes and I see the water is there. Now when I actually see the water is there, I don't need faith any longer because I see it. And then if I drink it, I am still more sure that it's not simply an imagination of my mind. So let me prove it now. Oh yes, it is there. Water is there. So when you see something, then you don't need faith. So faith in God is necessary until you actually have experience of God. Once you have experience of God, then faith had done its job. Then you are experiencing it. That is what he means by abiding this teaching of mine, full of Shraddha and free from cavilling. The cavilling means well, there are many different shades of meaning in this here. But one of the ways we can understand that is that in spiritual life there is no scope for competition. Or because sometimes you see the same mind that we have with which we do worldly activities, and we bring the same mind to do spiritual activities also, and just like there can be this kind of unhealthy kind of competition in the world, we can bring that kind of unhealthy competition in spiritual life also. Oh, that person thinks she can meditate better, I can meditate even more. That person thinks got a better asana, I can get a more expensive asana. You know, this kind of pettiness can come even in those who practice spiritual life. And so what oftentimes they advise in spiritual life is you don't have to compete with anybody else. Compete with your own self. Which means, how do I know whether I am progressing in spiritual life? Don't compare your life with somebody else's life. Ask yourself, today, am I a better person today than what I was 5 years ago? If I feel, so it's kind of taking assessment of your own life. What I was 5 years ago, 10 years ago, and what I am now, do I see any improvement? Or do I think, 10 years ago I was a much better person than I am now? That means obviously something has gone wrong. But if you find that, no, as a result of my prayer, as a result of meditation, as a result of doing japa, I think I am better person today. In these respects, this is the progress I have done. There are certain situations I can handle better today than I could have done 2 years ago or 3 years ago. So that is how we compare our progress with our own selves. Not comparing like, that person meditates so much and I'm able to meditate more than that person. That kind of competition is not good. So we have to be, it's very important, because sometimes people think that just because they have taken the spiritual life, automatically overnight they have become saints. It doesn't happen that way. And so we have to be very humble about our progress. And so if we can take care of all these things, then we will be also released from action. Released from action means we are all kind of bound, caught up in this chain of work and its results, work and its results, which is what binds us to the samsara. But if we can live that way, we can be free from that chain reaction. Verse 32.
Yetvetadabhyasuyanto
nanu tishtanti me matam
sarvajnana
vimudhanstan
vidhi nashtana
chetasaha.
But those who carp at my teaching and act not thereon, deluded in all knowledge and devoid of discrimination, know them to be ruined. So again, sometimes our ego is so strong that we just see this and say, oh, this doesn't make sense to me. And if it doesn't make sense to me, it cannot be any good. So we sit in judgment over these teachings. Now we know that in when we go to school, it's the teacher who judges the student. But the moment the student starts judging, the one who judges is the teacher. Now if I start judging this teaching, that means I am the teacher and Krishna is the student. And then of course, then we are in trouble. And so again, why do I feel I'm capable of judging these things? Because of my ego. I feel that I can understand everything. So there is something here which doesn't make sense to me, then it's no good. It cannot be right. It cannot be true. But a humble person will say, wait a minute. Maybe I'm not understanding it correctly. Maybe I need to look at it deeply. Maybe I need to reflect over it deeply. Or maybe I can go and seek somebody else's guidance. Maybe I can see how others are understanding it. So a truly humble person who wants knowledge will not immediately come to any rash conclusion, who would reflect, who would think. And those who don't do it, those who come to judgment immediately based on their own egoistic ideas, then such a person would come to ruin, which means it will take a long time for them to see light. Verse 33.
Sadrisham cheshtate swasyaha.
Sadrisham cheshtate swasyaha.
Prakriter jnanavanapi.
Prakriter jnanavanapi.
Prakritim yanti bhutani.
Prakritim yanti bhutani.
Nigrahav kim karishyati.
Nigrahav kim karishyati.
Even a wise person behaves in conformity with his own nature. Beings follow nature. What shall restraint avail? So one thing what happens in life is this. Our minds have certain tendencies. Those tendencies come from the presence of samskaras, the mental impressions. Mental impressions are created as a result of our actions and thoughts. And so we react to things, we make choices, we take decisions based upon our mental tendencies. And that's what most people do. And the general way life goes on is everybody follows their instincts. And therefore we see that although similar situations may come in the lives of us, all of us may react differently to it. Because we have, our minds are constituted with the different impressions, different tendencies. And that is why controlling that nature is so difficult. That is the nigrahav kim karishyati, what can restraint do? So oftentimes when we make mistakes in life, it's not always that we make mistake through ignorance. Because if you make mistake through ignorance, it's you are not at fault. For instance, now if you know that one person, it is said, was walking on a sidewalk and then there was a banana peel there and he didn't notice it. He stepped on it, slipped and fell down and was hurt. So it was a mistake, but he didn't see it, so it was done out of ignorance. But then there was an enlightenment, because you get the knowledge stepping on a banana peel is not a good idea. So you know that it shouldn't be done. So next day this person is going and again sees a banana peel and says, oh, aaj bhi girna padega. So do I have to now fall down today also? No, you don't have to. You have just because a banana peel is there, or this person might say, well, yesterday I fell down, doesn't mean that today also I'll fall down, let me try. Not is it necessary that I need to fall myself to learn. Maybe I see somebody else slipping on a banana peel. So I can learn from somebody else's experience as well. So we need to learn from experience. But oftentimes we don't do it. We actually, every mistake teaches us something. And if we learn from every mistake, then actually making mistakes is wonderful. Because every mistake we learn something. But the trouble is, we are not even original at making mistakes. Most of our mistakes are the same mistakes. It's very repetitive. And so which essentially means we are not learning anything. We just keep on doing the same old thing over and over and over again. And it's not just individuals, even civilizations, even nations. And why does history repeat itself? Because everyone has been doing the same thing over and over again. So if we must make mistakes, let's make fresh mistakes every time. And every mistake should teach us something. So we become wiser every time. But because we don't do it, we keep on making same mistakes. And that is why even when we do something wrong, it is not always that we don't know it's wrong. We know it's wrong, we don't want to do it, and yet we do it. Why? Because our nature kind of drags us to it. And therefore, when we are getting dragged in one direction, to go against that direction is always more tough. It's easier to swim downstream than upstream. So now, as a result of tendencies acquired through all past births, our mind is kind of dragging us in one direction, one way it's moving. And if we want to follow the path of least resistance, just give in to it. I think it was Bernard Shaw who said, the best way to overcome a temptation is to give in to it. Then it's gone. But that way, we again fall into that same rut, same old cycle. So if we now want to go against this habit that we have formed, then we need extra effort. And therefore, spiritual life is for really courageous people. It's not meant for losers. It's not meant for somebody like, oh, I tried everything, nothing works, so let me try religion. It doesn't work. I remember years ago, many years ago, sometime I think in early 80s or something, I was in a Madras monastery, and one person came and he met the Swamiji who was there, and he said that I have a nephew who was not studying, and he tried to get into medical college, didn't get admission, then he tried for engineering, didn't get there, and he's now very frustrated, he doesn't succeed. So finally I told him, why don't you go and join the mission and become a Swami? You see, but yeah, I mean, as if like nowhere else you could succeed. And so, all right, then now take to spiritual life. No, if we cannot be a success in the world, if we cannot be a success in secular life, there is no chance. You need much more courage. You need much more perseverance. You need much more grit in spiritual life. And so, reason is this. You see, there is certain amount of courage, of course, is necessary. You know, courage to go to a battle and fight for your country. Or courage necessary in doing all these protests, or whichever way. I mean, there are different instances of courage in the world. But you need a much greater courage in spiritual life. Partly because the worldview that is being presented here is sometimes so radically different from the way we have been leading our lives. So we are literally being asked to change our way of understanding the world. Literally being asked to look at everything with a different eye. And that's tough. We can make changes in our food, we can make changes in our that's also tough for many people, but that somehow can be done. But to make changes in our self-understanding, make changes in the way we understand the world, the way we understand God, the way we understand our relationships, that's a major, major change. And most people are not ready for it. It's frightening. And therefore you need much, much greater courage. That if we believe something to be right, if we believe something to be true, do I have the courage to live according to my convictions? Otherwise it becomes just a dual life, just like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. At the intellectual level you say, oh yeah, all this kind of sounds good, sounds true. I think it's true, but it doesn't touch my day-to-day life at all. My life, day-to-day life goes in one direction, and then occasionally once a week, my life's like, ah, this Brahman and God. And there is no connection between how I live and all this talk about God. Then it does won't make any difference at all. That is what is said here. Verse 34.
इन्द्रियस्यार्थे रागद्वेषौ व्यवस्थितौ तयोर्दवशमागच्छेत् तौ ह्यस्य परिपन्थिनौ.
Attachment and aversion of the senses for their respective objects are natural, but let none come under their domination, they are verily his enemies. So two things, raga and dvesha, that is attachment, raga is attachment and dvesha is hatred. So long as we have these two, life can never be peaceful and joyful for us. So we need to reduce our attachment, we need to reduce our hatred for things. So people who have intense dislikes and intense likes find it very difficult to lead spiritual life. So I'm not saying that straight away you shouldn't have any likes or dislikes. That's not what I'm saying. As human beings, certain things you will agree with you, certain things you may not agree with you, you may like a few things, you may dislike a few things, that's fine. But like intense hatred, that I don't even want to see the face of that person, or if something is put into my plate, I will throw away that plate if I don't, you know, there's a problem there. So the more we are able to reduce this intensity of either attachment or hatred, the more balanced we become, the better our lives are. Otherwise, these, as Krishna says, that these are our enemies. So, bad enough to have enemies outside. You know, these are enemies inside. Enemies outside, at least you can protect yourself. Close your door, put a security lock. What do you do with the enemies who are here? We are carrying with them all the time. And so, we need to take good care of ourselves so that these enemies who are inside can be eliminated. Verse 35. Shriyan Swadharmo Vigunaha
Shriyan Swadharmo Vigunaha
Paradharmat Svanushtitat
Paradharmat Svanushtitat
Swadharme Nidhanam Shriyaha
Swadharme Nidhanam Shriyaha
Paradharmo Bhayavaha
Paradharmo Bhayavaha.
One's own dharma, though imperfect, is better than the dharma of another well discharged. Better death in one's own dharma, the dharma of another is full of fear. And this is a little bit of a verse which creates a lot of confusion in the minds of people. And some people have tried to give a kind of a modern interpretation to this verse. What I will try to do is, I will refrain from trying to give a modern interpretation. You just have to remember that the Gita was preached, well, at least more than 2,000 to 3,000, God knows, but long, long ago. And the society of those times was very different from today. So, the notion of Swadharma needs to be understood in the context of the society of those days. So, Dharma means duty. So, what is essentially being said here is that better to do one's own duty than somebody else's duty. I think just try to understand how the situation may have been in those old days. Sometimes these teachings don't make sense because we are trying to look at a 3000 year old teaching from the mindset of a 21st century. And not, I this is my personal opinion, after there can be various opinions on this. I believe that not every word that Krishna said has to be immediately relevant to us today. I believe that this is part of the Mahabharata. Mahabharata is a story set in a particular social context. And there are teachings here which refer to the society of those days. And the society has changed. Well, society changes almost in every century. Just imagine, we're talking about several thousand year old society. So some of the teachings which refer specifically to the social context, they either need a modern interpretation, or we say just is not relevant to us today. But the teaching regarding God, the Atma, or the body, mind, the ego, those are relevant because these things have not changed. That human situation has not changed, but society has changed. So this Swadharma, understood in the, as a social teaching, is this. First of all, even not too long ago, what to speak of 1,000 years ago, there was not easy, not only no easy way to communicate with one another, but no easy way even to travel. Even, I mean, forget about thousands of years ago, even our great-grandfathers and grandfathers, most of the people, before this jet travel came along, or even before the automobile came along, pretty much most people, they were born in a particular place, they grew up there, they raised families there, they grew older, they died there. People didn't travel much. Now, today it may be very, it might seem inconceivable that people might remain confined within a certain area. But in olden times, it was not easy to travel. And there was even no need to travel. First of all, they didn't even know how big the world was. I mean, when Columbus came, he didn't even know, like, new world, we don't even know what's there. The seas were not charted. So, there was so much, everyone kind of lived in their small little worlds. Now, just imagine a town or a village. There is no easy communication, there is no travel, and yet people have to live their lives. So every town needed a doctor, you need some priest, you need a blacksmith, you need a plumber, you need pretty much somebody to do these things. And there were no schools. You couldn't say, okay, now let me go and study engineering. There was no this thing. So essentially the only place you could study something was from your parents. That's how these hereditary professions came. So there was a plumber in the village, and the plumber got old. No, does that village have to go without a plumber? No. And so that plumber had a son or a nephew, said, okay, now I'm getting old, you have got to learn. And so they learned the trade from their parents. And that's how specific traits got associated with certain families. And today we might say, like, oh, everybody should be allowed to do what they like. Why should a plumber's son become a plumber? Why should a doctor's son? What if the doctor's son says, I'm not interested in medicine, let me go for plumbing. But who's going to teach you plumbing? Where are you going to go? There are no schools. Plus, if that village has only one doctor and the doctor's son is not interested in medicine, does that mean that next generation has to live without doctors? So that's why the society said, nothing doing. So for a collective good, you have no freedom. You are born in that family, you have to do medicine whether you like it or not. That is your swadharma. That is your duty. And we might say, but what about our individual freedom? We know that when we live together as a group, we do sacrifice our individual freedoms for a collective good. Of course, nowadays it's becoming even more clear with people, there's this big tension between how much of our individual freedoms are being taken away for protecting the American people. And there's all this thing about terrorism. Should the government have access to your emails? Should they tap your phones? And you might say, no, we have our individual freedom, but wait a minute, but the country has to be protected. And so there is always this tension between how much of our own personal freedom are we willing to surrender? And this tension exists. And I'm sure something like that existed even those days. Well, I'm not interested in this, but wait a minute, but for the collective good, you've got to do it. For instance now, if you're driving, you might say, why should I follow traffic rules? I like to drive on the other side. The society said, no, you can't do it. So we do accept limits on our freedom put by his society, because we know it's good for the collective, this thing. So exactly in the same way, in ancient India, they put these limits for the good of the society. So this village needs a plumber, the village needs a doctor, the village needs a priest. And so, Swadharma here, therefore it is said, better to die doing your own dharma rather than doing somebody else's dharma. Because first of all, it is going to affect the social system. The second thing it's going to do is, the reason for this is, the focus in the Gita is not in what work you are doing, but how you are doing the work. The problem comes when we try to assign value to a particular work. For instance, if we say somehow a priest is a higher work than a sweeper or a trader or a warrior. So when we assign a value and say this is at the higher level, this is at the lower level, then of course nobody wants to be at the lower level. And so they say, why should I do this work? Why should I not do that work? But this value was never assigned to the work. That's not what this whole... Hindus generally tend to get very defensive. Caste system, then either... and this happens so often in the campuses I've seen. In any discussion on Hinduism, first thing about untouchability. Casteism, why do you have this? As if caste is like... the whole Hinduism is based on caste. As if the caste is so integral a part of Hinduism, which it is not. Caste is a social system. It was part of a Hindu society at one time. It's not now. Legally not. But we know that in rural parts of India especially, the caste consciousness is still strong. But oftentimes, it's not legislature or law cannot eliminate deep-seated values and prejudices. Even in this country, racial segregation is not legal anymore. But that, does that mean that the racial prejudice has completely gone? No. Same thing in England. So sometimes someone said, what is caste in India is class in England and race in the United States. So the legal system would go in one way. The government will make rules in one way. But these deep-seated prejudices and biases that people have take time to go. Same thing has happened with the caste in India. I mean, if you go to cities now, you go in a train or a bus, you have no idea who is sitting next to you. Can't say, are you untouchable? I will not sit next to you. Can't say that. If you go to a restaurant, you don't know who has cooked your food, who is bringing it. But if you see the textbooks on Hinduism, it's like caste. And those who have actually been, I mean, most of my life I lived in India, and I find, why is people making such big deal about caste? Nowadays, the question about caste comes in some families only at the time of marriage. Or some of the more orthodox families say, oh, I want my son or daughter to marry in the same caste. But even I think that's so much a phenomenon that's dying out slowly. I think the next generation of parents, so the next two or three generations, it will go. This is not going to be a big deal at all. So caste is kind of dying out, which is inevitable, as no social institution is eternal. As changes occur, the society will have to modify its institutions to accommodate the changes. And so this Swadharma thing, therefore I generally don't try to kind of give some kind of a modern interpretation, because none of these modern interpretations have I'm particularly satisfied me. So I just try to look upon it as just a way it was dealt with in ancient time, because this is an ancient text. The Gita was not written yesterday, and so that is what is meant here. And the one point that I wanted to stress was, so the Gita approach is not about what work you are doing, but how you are doing it. So there is no such thing as a lowly work or a high level work. In that respect, I was very happy when I came to this country and to see although I mean I was new and on the surface I saw, but I see that there is values attached to different works even here, which is of course a very common human way of doing things. But in general, I have found compared to India is the only country I know in Asia, I haven't really lived in any other country, in Asian country, that there is a greater, relatively speaking, greater dignity of labor here than in India. India, it's that value is very strong. I've seen in Madras, for instance, that some people would rather go and do a low-paying clerical job somewhere, but may not want to go and become a plumber or a construction worker. Although they may be getting much more money, but they say, "Oh no, in our family, we cannot go and do that kind of work." So that thing that my family only certain kind of works we will do, and others are kind of lowly work. That's the wrong way of doing things. On the other hand, I was very happy when I came here and I found a lot of these college students, no matter which family, in summer vacation, I go and take a job as waiting tables or go to McDonald's. Nobody bothered, like, oh, that's kind of a low paying or things like that. Which later on I realized that value system is still there, but not at least in my impression is not as much as I have noticed it in India. So the importance, to come back to what I was saying before, is not what you are doing but how you are doing it. If you can even, suppose someone's job is only say cleaning a place, cleaning your courtyard and doing it well, you can attain enlightenment just cleaning your courtyard properly. And someone else may be doing some apparently high level work, and that person can be completely attached to the world and may remain a long time in samsara. So it's not what work you do that is going to determine your spiritual progress. It's how you do it. And since what work you do was never important, the society felt no qualms in saying, you got to do this, you got to do this, you have no freedom. Because it really doesn't matter what you're doing. Are you doing it well? But now the times in which we live today, the value system has changed. It's so much, I mean, nowadays, who thinks in terms of how you do? It's the, first of all, economy has become so major a factor, then naturally, the one primary consideration that goes is, I want to take a job that pays me well. Whether or not I have interest in it, and it's more in India though than here. Here at least I find there is some consideration given to doing something in which you have interest. But again, not just India, I keep on saying India because that's the only country I know. But in many developing countries where the economic condition is not so high, the primary consideration is economic. And so people don't often see that I want to do something in which I find fulfillment, but I want to do something which will pay me well. So then I can maintain my family, I can raise our living standard. And so people end up doing things which are high paying, but which don't bring them joy. And which is why then we turn to hobbies. We turn to doing something on weekends, which we enjoy doing. And so our life gets divided. So weekdays is a time I do something to earn my living, to pay my bills. But weekend is something I can do what I want, which essentially means I have sold away 5 days of my own life and only 2 days of my life is really belong to me. And which is why does everyone look forward to a weekend? We look forward to weekend because we feel at that time I am free. My time belongs to me. And it's not like everybody just resting throughout the weekend. A lot of people do a lot of activity during weekend, but they do what they enjoy doing. And because they enjoy doing it, it doesn't tire them. But our day to day, the work which we do throughout the week, if it is something we don't enjoy doing, we get exhausted at the end of the day. The exhaustion is not so much due to work, although the work itself, I mean the body is like a machine, body will get exhausted, but a lot more exhaustion occurs because we don't enjoy what we are doing. So if we can somehow find a way by finding fulfillment in the work that we have to do anyway, then every day can be a weekend, every day can be a vacation, if we enjoy doing what we are doing. So it's in that way we need to understand this context about Swadharma. And this is what I have said so far is not definitely the only explanation. You will find many different interpretations of these verses. Feel free to accept whichever appeals to you. I have just shared with you what appeals to me. That's all. So verse 36. Arjuna. Now Arjuna asks the next question. Arjuna vacha.
Arjuna vacha.
Athakena prayuktoyam.
Athakena prayuktoyam.
Papam charati purushaha.
Papam charati purushaha.
Anichchan apivarshneya.
Anichchan apivarshneya.
Baladiva niyochitaha.
Baladiva niyochitaha.
Arjuna said, but dragged on by what does a man commit sin? Unwillingly though, O Vashneya, constrained as it were by force. So even though we know certain things are wrong, certain things are not in our best self-interest, why do we still do those things? That is what Krishna, Arjuna asks. Now Krishna replies, Shri Bhagavan Uvacha.
Shri Bhagavan Uvacha.
Kama yesha krodha yesha.
Kama yesha krodha yesha.
Rajo guna samudbhavaha.
Rajo guna samudbhavaha.
Mahashano mahapapma.
Mahashano mahapapma.
Vidhenam miha vairinam.
Vidhenam miha
vairinam.
Vidhenam iha vairinam.
Vidhenam iha vairinam.
The Blessed Lord said, it is desire, it is wrath begotten by the Rajoguna, all-consuming, all-sinful, know this as the foe here on earth. Kama and Krodha, desire and anger, these are the two enemies. The more we are able to get rid of them, the happier we will be. And they are interconnected. In the second chapter, you must remember that how all, it's a kind of a chain reaction. It begins by dhyayato visayan punsaha. First, some thought of some object comes to our mind. Sangasteshu pachayate. As soon as that thought of an object comes, attachment comes to it. Sangat sanjayate kamaha. As soon as that attachment comes, if that thing is something pleasant, I want it. If it is something unpleasant, I want to run away from it. So either way, I am reacting to it. So kama, desire comes. Kama bhavati, what? Sangat sanjayate kamaha. Kama kro kama krodho vijayate. Then the desire produces anger if there is an obstacle. You see? Again, if the obstacle is weaker than me, produces anger, because then I can scold that person, whoever is obstructing it. If that obstacle is stronger than me, then I only feel angry inside, because showing anger outside to a more powerful person is not a good idea. So such people, either it produces misery or a deep-seated anger inside. It's like in your office, if your boss does something which you don't like, you can't always explode. You don't like it, but you just keep quiet because you don't want to say something and make your boss unhappy with you. And so some people go to the other extreme. Maybe they don't like it, they say, "Ah, oh, it's so wonderful." but if you are the boss and you don't like something, you can afford to get angry. So this desire produces anger. So this kama and krodha, and of course that in the second chapter it goes on to show how ultimately it memory gets deluded and how ultimately only sorrow and pain result from it. But these are the two things Krishna points out, desire and attachment and anger, which are at the root of all the difficulties we experience. Verse 38.
Dhumena vriyate vannihi.
Dhumena vriyate vannihi.
Yatha darsho malena cha.
Yatha darsho malena cha.
Yatholbena vruto garbhaha.
Yatholbena vruto garbhaha.
Tatha tene tama vritam.
Tatha tene tama vritam.
So how does our understanding get covered? A lot of examples are given here. As fire is enveloped by smoke, as a mirror by dust, or as an embryo by the womb, so is this covered by that. So how our understanding get covered? Three examples are given here. Then a further analysis in the next verse.
Avritam jnanametena.
Avritam jnanametena.
Jnanino nityavairina.
Jnanino nityavairina.
Kamarupena kaunteya.
Kamarupena kaunteya.
Dushpurena nalena cha.
Dushpurena nalena cha.
Knowledge is covered, O son of Kunti, by this insatiable desire of fire of desire, the constant foe of the wise. So both knowledge gets covered and of course a cloud of understanding. So both these verses then give examples of how the covering occurs within us. And where does this desire reside? The next verse gives the answer. Verse 40.
Indriyani mano buddhihi.
Indriyani mano buddhihi.
Asya tishthana mucchate.
Asya tishthana mucchate.
Etair vimohayatyesha.
Etair vimohayatyesha.
Jnanam avrityadehinam.
Jnanam avrityadehinam.
The senses, the mind and the intellect are said to be its seat. By these it deludes man by veiling his wisdom. So these desires are rooted in the senses, in the mind and the intellect, in these coverings over us, and they delude our understanding. And how to then eliminate the desires is taught in the next verse, 41.
Tasmatvam indriyanyadau.
Tasmatvam indriyanyadau.
Niyamya bharatarshabha.
Niyamya bharatarshabha.
Papmanam prajahiyenam.
Papmanam prajahiyenam.
Jnana vijnana nashanam.
Jnana vijnana nashanam.
Therefore, eminent of the Bharatas, mastering first the senses slayed the sinful, the destroyer of knowledge and realization. Mastering the senses, having control over the senses. At present we have absolutely no control over the senses. Which really means, for instance now, if I open my eyes, I have to see what is in front. I really have no control. I mean, at the most I can close my eyes, but why can I not tell my eyes be open and tell my mind don't see? Nothing will work. If my ears are in working condition, any sound, I have to hear it. No freedom. But you can control your senses. We see, for instance, in the life of Swami Sharadananda, we can see the one who wrote the life of Ramakrishna. He was there in a place in Calcutta called Udbodhan, where Holy Mother used to stay. And he was almost like a doorkeeper of Mother. So he was sitting, those of you who have gone to Calcutta and seen that place, it's a very narrow place, he would be sitting just near the door and all people passing by. And there was so much sound there. And sitting in that spot, he wrote this profound philosophical work. And he used to say, when he sat there, he said, I told my ears, don't hear. And he didn't put earplugs or anything. It will be in complete silence. He could do his work in complete silence. Another great disciple of Ramakrishna was Swami Turiyananda. And he was here in this country for what, I guess about 2 years or so in California. Then when he returned home, in his later years, he developed carbuncles. I don't know what's the current name for that, medical name for that. I think some kind of boils, I guess, on the back or something. And so they had to be operated. And he refused to take anesthesia. He just told the doctor, before you put your knife, just warn me in advance, tell me. And so, with no anesthesia, the doctor told him, okay, are you ready, Swamiji? And he said he could withdraw his mind from the body. And that entire operation was done without anesthesia. Now, I'm not suggesting that we, any of us, try that. But I'm mentioning this only to show that it's not simply a theory, that there are people who have been able to do it. And, well, these are kind of extreme cases in the case of people who have become adepts in all of this. But even in our own little way, a control of the senses would mean, if you are busy with some major work, can you, for the time being, say, I don't want to think any other thoughts. I want to put my whole mind into this. Or when you are meditating, can you tell your mind, don't think any other thoughts? You see, control of senses. Mind is an inner sense. It's called antakkarana. Why is it that we find so difficult to meditate in the beginning? Oh, my mind is running here and there. Why don't you tell your mind not to run? Our mind doesn't listen. So that means I am not able to control my own mind. Or if some people have, say, sugar problem, and then the doctor says, stop eating sweets. And not that we forget, we know it's not good for us. Still, when you open the refrigerator and you see something sweet, then automatically the hand goes there. There is no control. And so these are the things, these little things in which we can try to practice. And if we can do that, then this is what he says, mastering the senses, the sinful, the destroyer of knowledge and realization. So all of these can be removed if we make conscious effort to control our senses. Verse 42.
Indriyani paranyahuhu.
Indriyani paranyahuhu.
Indriyebhyah param manaha.
Indriyebhyah param manaha.
Manasastu para buddhih.
Manasastu para buddhih.
Yo buddheh paratastu saha.
Yo buddheh paratastu saha.
Now, how are these different layers over our personality related? In what way do these layers get uncovered? That is given here. The senses are said to be superior to the body. The mind is superior to the senses. The intellect is superior to the mind. And what is superior to the intellect is Atman. So first, therefore, you begin with the senses. If you control the senses, then it becomes easier to control the body. If you control the body, the next thing will be, it becomes easier to control the mind. Then the next would be to control the intellect. And so this way, so we go in steps. And so we begin with the senses and gradually we keep on controlling this, and ultimately we reach that inner controller, which is the Atman. Verse 43.
Evam buddheh param buddhva.
Evam buddheh param buddhva.
Samstabhyatmanam atmana.
Samstabhyatmanam atmana.
Jahi shatrum mahabaho.
Jahi shatrum mahabaho.
Kamarupam durasadam.
Kamarupam durasadam.
Thus, knowing him as superior to the intellect, restraining the self by the self, slay, O mighty armed, the enemy in the form of desire, difficult to overcome. So this chapter therefore ends with a very forceful plea to make conscious effort to remove desire and attachment, because the source of all our pain and sorrow, anxiety and stress in life is attachment. Now we might say, well, it's easy to simply say get rid of attachment, but how easy it is to actually do it? An easier way is, can we change the direction of our attachment? It is like this. Our mind has a limited capacity to get attached. It's like for instance, how much memory is installed in your computer? If you have loaded it with some lot of software, and then you open the programs and your memory is full and there is nothing more you can add to it. And then if you have some new program has come and you want to say, oh, I would like to have it, but there is no place in it. So then what do? You say, well, let me see which of these useless things I have already in it. Then you say, let me get rid of this stuff, and then you can make space for it. So if we can keep only useful attachments on our hard drive here, then all useless stuff can be removed. And so if we can therefore say develop a strong attachment to God, a strong attachment to our spiritual ideal, then all these useless attachments will automatically go away. So it's not that we remove attachment for this and that and just leave a vacuum there. So the more we are able to love a higher spiritual ideal, these lower attachments will automatically fall away. That's what Krishna ends this chapter with. So let's read that closing thing. Iti Srimad Bhagavad Gita Su.
Iti Srimad Bhagavad Gita Su.
Upanishad Su.
Upanishad Su.
Brahma Vidyayam.
Brahma Vidyayam.
Yoga Shastre.
Yoga Shastre.
Sri Krishna Arjuna Samvade.
Sri Krishna Arjuna Samvade.
Karma Yoga Nama.
Karma Yoga Nama.
Tritiyodhyayah. Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Tat Sat Shri Ramakrishna Arpanamastu.